From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media.
A word for excretion.
Bob Garfield is away this week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
For urination. For having sex. For breasts. And three words still so radioactive, we can't even describe them.
Comedian George Carlin died last Sunday, not exactly breaking news by now, but we couldn't resist the urge to talk about those words we're not supposed to talk about, what the Federal Communications Commission calls indecency, the ones Carlin mentioned in his now infamous stand-up act from the 1970s, which became the subject of a Supreme Court case after a New York City radio station played the routine, uncensored, live over the air at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. In FCC versus Pacifica, the court ruled against the radio station, stating that broadcast media have, quote, limited First Amendment protection, in part because they are, quote, uniquely accessible to children. Glenn Garvin is TV critic for the Miami Herald. He says that broadcast or not, TV today is littered with the words that Carlin said you can't say on TV.
The show Deadwood on HBO used the F word so often that a website actually began counting them and working out what it called the FPM. That's F words per minute.
Mm-hmm.
And over three seasons, it averaged 1.56 F words per minute, which is a pretty impressive total, really.
Of course, now it doesn't even take a subscription to cable TV to hear at least some of the words from Carlin's routine. I've noticed them popping up on broadcast channels now and again.
They've done so rather infamously the last few years, particularly from the mouths of Hollywood celebrities sort of commandeering the airwaves during award shows and things like that.
Right. We have the Bono example.
That's really, really f***ing brilliant. And really, really great.
The FCC got complaints over the Bono's use of the F word, which they very curiously decided was not something they could penalize because he used the word as an adverb rather than as a noun or a verb.
And then there was that other example on the Today Show.
Even a jaded old TV critic like myself was somewhat startled when Jane Fonda, discussing her appearance in a play called The Vagina Monologues, used another word for vagina that starts with a C.
Well, it wasn't that I wasn't a big fan. I hadn't seen the play. I live in Georgia, okay? I was asked to do a monologue called and I said, I don't think so. I got enough problems.
20, 25 years ago, the sky would have fallen. The network would have been burned to the ground, probably. Instead, they just apologized, and so far, at least, that's been the end of it.
It's happened from time to time since the dawn of broadcasting, and yet there seems to be a renewed interest by the FCC in cracking down on these violations. Is it because there are more complaints?
There were 14,000 complaints to the FCC in 2002. In 2003, it was up to 170,000. And the FCC is now so far behind on logging these complaints that we only have statistics available through the first half of 2006. But for just the first 6 months of 2006, more than 327,000 complaints. So not everybody is cool with this by any means. I think that the Parents Television Council, which has truly made it easy for its members to lodge complaints through its website, the reason they exist is that there are a lot of people truly offended by this who don't like it. They've got over a million members.
Fair enough. You pointed out that George Carlin often referred to himself as a footnote in American legal history.
I think Carlin would be highly amused that in his death, he's so often remembered for this one little routine.
There are 400,000 words in the English language, and there are seven of them you can't say on television. What a ratio that is. 399,993 to 7. They must really be bad. They'd have to be outrageous to be separated from a group that large. All of you over here, you seven. Bad word. No bad words. Bad thoughts. Bad intentions. And words. You know the seven, don't you, that you can't say on television? Shit, piss, fuck, suck a mother, huh?
I think frankly, America's all mixed up about this. I don't think Americans know what they want. I don't doubt that people are really ticked off. You know, Gallup and these organizations do polls all the time, and they show repeatedly that a solid majority of Americans think there's too much sex and too much violence and too much swearing on television. Then you turn around and you look at the Nielsen ratings, and more people than ever are watching television. And what's more, increasingly, they prefer cable television, where the sex and the violence and the dirty words are far more than they are on broadcast. And I don't think we've made up our minds quite yet which direction we're going to go on this.
Glenn Garvin is the TV critic for the Miami Herald. Glenn, thank you very much.
Thank you.
If America can't make up its mind, well, neither can the courts. Historically, the FCC has allowed what are called fleeting expletives, that is, off-the-cuff profanity on live TV, to pass without fines. But a November 2006 ruling changed that. The utterances in question occurred during successive broadcasts of the Billboard Music Awards on Fox. In the first instance, Cher, after receiving a Lifetime Achievement Award, said this.
I've also had critics for the last 40 years saying that I was on my way out every year. Right. So, f*** them.
The following year, Nicole Richie also used the F word, and the FCC deemed Fox guilty of indecency. In June 2007, in Fox Television Stations, Inc. versus the FCC, the Second U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals said that the FCC acted arbitrarily and capriciously in deciding which fleeting expletives were indecent, and that the commission, quote, failed to articulate a reasoned basis for its change in policy. In other words, there was no historical precedent for fining fleeting expletives, so why now? The Supreme Court will hear that case later this fall. Until then, the battle rages on. As TV critic Glenn Garvin just mentioned, the Parents Television Council, or PTC, is one of the most influential anti-indecency groups in the country. We spoke with PTC President Tim Winter shortly after the second court ruled against the FCC and in favor of the networks on the issue of fleeting expletives.
When you hear an expletive aired on an award show, and then again the next year, the same award show, a different celebrity utters the same word. At some point in time, this no longer becomes fleeting. It becomes a pattern.
A pattern that, according to Winter, the networks don't mind.
I think the networks not only didn't discourage their celebrities from doing that, I think there's some sort of tacit encouragement that they want the stars to be edgy because they are looking for young teen audiences that the advertisers want most.
The PTC's motto is, because our children are watching. And Winters means it, because in fact, he's watching his child watching.
As a father of a 9-year-old daughter, it became abundantly apparent to me several years ago just how impactful the media was on small children, regardless of how diligent a parent is at protecting what their children are watching.
For Tim Winter, a Supreme Court decision against a primetime expletive would benefit society at large. Not so for NYPD Blue creator Stephen Bochco. Bochco has made his career creating gritty dramas that employ expletives and even the occasional butt cheek in primetime.
Obviously, we conceptualized NYPD Blue to be a show that pushed at the bindings because in the early 1990s, the hour drama was kind of moribund on broadcast television, and cable was just having us for lunch. So in broad strokes, the mandate for NYPD Blue was to mature the medium somewhat.
And, says Bochco, when you're creating a program about New York City police, the occasional use of an expletive is part of the artistic process.
I never needed to show anybody's ass. I never needed to show anybody's breasts. I never needed to use the word ass. Those were creative choices. And I regret all kinds of things I've done, but I've never regretted them conceptually. I usually regret them simply because, for one reason or another, the execution wasn't good enough. You know, did we contextualize the moment sufficiently to make it appropriate?
Context is key to avoiding an FCC reprimand. We spoke with FCC Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein in 2005 and 2006. He explained why Bono's use of the F word during the Golden Globe Awards was indecent, while expletives littered through the film Saving Private Ryan, aired on broadcast TV, were not.
In the case of the Bono incident, it was gratuitous. It was during an awards show when parents would not be apprised that that kind of language would be used. In the case of Saving Private Ryan, there was many different disclosures done in advance. Even Senator John McCain went on the television before the movie was aired to say that parents may want to be careful about the kind of language that's being used here. This kind of language is a part of the very fabric of war. And so to change that would change the nature of the film. And we found that in that context, that certainly the use of the language was not indecent. And I'm really disappointed, frankly, that a lot of stations decided not to air it. And I'm concerned that we may be having something of a chilling effect on speech. And we need to avoid that in every way possible.
But how can you avoid that, he told us, when the FCC has no consistent criteria for judging what is indecent?
You look at the so-called Golden Globes case where Bono used the F word with regard to an award that he got. It wasn't certainly sexual in nature, but we found that it may have been. And once you go down that path, all of a sudden you have the whole vocabulary in front of you and you need to make these determinations. And in fact, I can see why broadcasters would be somewhat confused about what is and what isn't permissible. I mean, I think we need to be very careful about how we draw the line here, because the Supreme Court gave us a real short leash on which to determine what is and isn't indecent. If we overstep in these cases and the court knocks us down, we could potentially lose what limited authority we have to protect children from indecent material forever. It would actually take a constitutional amendment, amending the First Amendment, to be able to get the FCC authority back to limit material that we could all agree would be inappropriate for children.
All who? When the Supreme Court ruled against Pacifica Radio in the Carlin case, Justice William Brennan raised exactly that question in his dissent. Quote, "As surprising as it may be to individual members of this court, some parents may actually find Mr. Carlin's unabashed attitude toward the seven dirty words healthy and deem it desirable to expose their children to the manner in which Mr. Carlin diffuses the taboo surrounding the words. Such parents may constitute a minority of the American public, but the absence of great numbers willing to exercise the right to raise their children in this fashion does not alter the right's nature or its existence. Only the court's regrettable decision does that." Coming up, when in Chinese cyberspace, do as the Chinese censors do. But can American companies do better? This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. The internet was China's fastest and best aggregator of information after last month's earthquake, but Chinese media watchdogs say the era of internet freedom after the quake passed quickly, most visibly with the recent arrest of cyber dissident Huang Qi, apparently for condemning the government's response to the quake. Still, in China, most censorship is self-censorship, and that also applies to the U.S.-owned search engines that do business there. Forbes.com recently observed that these companies have generally caved in to the Chinese government's demands to censor some websites. They just can't seem to agree on just which sites those are. According to a new study conducted by Nart Villeneuve at the University of Toronto's Open Net Initiative, Google sometimes blocks the BBC, while Yahoo permits it, and Microsoft deletes Chinese entries from Wikipedia that the Chinese version of Google, Baidu.com, allows. Rebecca McKinnon is an internet specialist based at the University of Hong Kong, which just hosted the Chinese Internet Research Conference. We met her this month in Hong Kong and asked her to tell us how the Chinese net works. She gave us the entire 101 in a brisk 7 minutes. Take notes.
Well, basically, the Chinese internet is controlled on several levels. At one level, you have basically what's known as the Great Firewall. So if I'm inside China and I try to access, let's say, Human Rights Watch, I get an error message on my browser. Then the other part of the internet controls is controlling domestic websites. So if I run an online news service or I run a blogging service or a chat room or something, I'm responsible for all the content that appears and all the content that my users post. So I have to police it and take down anything politically objectionable or I lose my license. And then the third way is information surveillance and so on. So with emails and with internet service providers, keeping tabs on traffic going back and forth and so on. And so you basically have these three three levels. And American internet companies doing business in China are sort of caught in all of these different levels. You've got the search engines like Google who go in, and it turns out they initially went in just with their regular search engine. And a lot of Chinese people were doing searches on Google.com, and they would get results, and a number of them would be blocked. And so they'd click on the link, and they'd get an error message, and their internet connection would go down. And so Google's approach was, okay, we need to provide a censored service so that people can at least have part of our search engine that works well, even though we can't provide them with everything. So they devised Google.cn, which basically checks against the Great Firewall to see what's being blocked, and then they take out those results so that you're not receiving results that are blocked inside China for the most part. And this has been, you know, highly controversial. It is true that they censor their search results less than the Chinese most popular search engine Baidu. Google.cn also censors a lot less than Chinese Yahoo and Microsoft's Chinese search engine. So they claim, well, you know, it's better to be there in part rather than not all. We're still helping Chinese people get more information. Then with Microsoft, they have a blog hosting service, MSN Live, used to be called MSN Spaces, and they got a lot of bad PR when they took down the content of a number of Chinese bloggers a few years ago. That, again, they said they had to do in order to be in compliance, in order to conduct their business in China. And then with Yahoo, you had the most, I would say, direct complicity in what people felt was the most outrageous thing, which was that Yahoo's Chinese language email service has handed over at least four people to Chinese police who were subject to quote-unquote criminal investigations. But, you know, they were basically just sending information overseas or, you know, organizing political groups and this kind of thing. At any rate, it's a very difficult issue because these companies go in, they say it's better that we're there than not there, but in order to be there, we have to play by the rules. But no matter how you slice it, they are certainly contributing and helping to legitimize China's information tunnel vision as far as the population is concerned. They're contributing to the fact that the Chinese internet and the amount of information and the nature of the information you get on the Chinese internet is different from the global internet.
From where you sit, you're the best person to assess this sort of thing. Do you wish these companies would not cooperate, or are you glad they're there?
I think you can engage in a smart manner. I think it's really a matter of being honest and open and transparent with your users about what you're doing with their data, what information they're going to get and not going to get through your service, because this isn't just an issue in China. Frankly, globally, it's very difficult to point to a single country where you don't have governments on one side, users on the other, and companies in the middle being pushed by governments to do things that run counter, arguably, to the rights and interests of those users. I mean, even in the United States, recently we've had cases of telecom companies being pressured by the Bush administration to reveal data without warrants and so on and so on. Now, I'm not saying that the United States is China at all. But what I am saying is that we have a global problem that no country is immune to unless there is no internet. So maybe North Korea doesn't have this problem, but pretty much everybody else has this problem to some degree. And what we need to do is make sure that we're not having a race to the bottom. We need to make sure that the companies who are doing business in the most authoritarian countries are not setting the standards of business practice for internet and telecommunications companies globally. And that is a danger with what's going on in China. And so the issue is, actually, I'm involved at the moment with an effort to get internet and telecoms companies to sign on to a global code of conduct for free expression and privacy. And the point is, look, okay, we understand most governments are going to make you censor something. In the United States, you have to censor kiddie porn and, you know, YouTube censors copyright violations. In pretty much every country, law enforcement requires you to hand over user data in the case of criminal investigations. That certainly happens in the United States. The issue is, are you being honest with your users? So a user, be it in China or in the United States or wherever they are, before they send that whistleblowing email, before they set up that email group to organize an opposition party, or before they send the report that's exposing their government for human rights violations to an overseas website, they have a better understanding of how their data might be used so they can make intelligent choices about what services to use. And that's, I think, the main issue we have with China today. I think to say, oh, disengage from China, nobody should do business in China until China's perfect. Frankly, if we want to hold China to those standards, we should shut down most business in the United States as well. You know? So the line needs to be drawn. We need to figure out how to do this intelligently.
It needs to be drawn here.
Well, yeah, I mean, China, again, is sort of the testing ground for how far human beings are going to allow technology companies to collude with governments and not care.
Rebecca McKinnon is an assistant professor at the Journalism and Media Studies Department at the University of Hong Kong. Like everything else in China, we learned that there are many sides to the story of the Internet. It isn't just control, censorship, and surveillance. It's also an effective tool for people to organize themselves. And organization is, of course, the key to people power. A few weeks ago in Beijing, I asked Jeremy Goldkorn, who runs the Chinese media site Donwei.org, to give us some examples of the Internet as vanguard for social change.
There were a few really notable examples last year, I think the most prominent of which was the brick kiln slave scandal, which broke in May 2007, in which a factory in Shanxi province making bricks had enslaved about 400 children and was using them as slave labor to make bricks. They were in cahoots with the local authorities, so some of the parents found out where they were and went there to try and free them. They couldn't because the local cops were stopping this. And they got together and they wrote a letter, which somebody helped post to a very popular forum website called Tianya, asking for help to free their children. And it became a, you know, almost overnight scandal on the Chinese internet. Very quickly goes picked up by Chinese newspapers. And, you know, within a few weeks, the government had shut the factory down and sacked, I think, about 90 provincial officials. This came completely out of the internet. Around the same time, June of last year, there was a protest against a chemical factory that was to make something called PX, or paraxylene, which local residents didn't want the factory near the place where they had just bought houses. And a protest movement was organized using SMS messages on cell phones and the internet. And the factory later was forced to move. So it is starting to happen where both sort of activist movements and actual news information are emerging first on the internet and then making their way into the mainstream media or government attention.
Can you describe what the odd conditions are in which provincial reporters can do their work? My understanding is that you can do investigative reporting in the provinces, but there are restrictions on what reporters can do in their own towns, not so much in towns to which they are not assigned. It gives rise to some peculiar situations, doesn't it?
Yeah, the thing is that as far as the central government goes, what they're scared of is a challenge to their power. When it comes to local issues, it's not a central government priority. And in fact, often the central government, if you could say, likes investigation of local officials, because that's, I mean, from time immemorial in China, that's been a problem of the central government, how to rein in local officials, the corruption of local officials. So from the central government point of view, they don't mind people investigating local corrupt practices or other bad things going on locally. However, each local government, obviously there are many vested interests, and if your local government in X town in the middle of Gansu has just signed a deal for a factory that's going to pollute, and you know, you're the one, the local government stands to gain and local business interests stand to gain, those type of officials and business people will be very harsh in trying to stop media from reporting on it. So often the local newspaper, local radio station will not dare to do it because they feel too vulnerable. Of course, the internet changes everything a little bit because it means, you know, you might have a newspaper in Guangzhou, but you put it on the internet, the whole country can see it. But by this time, hopefully you're far away from the local officials who might seek to do you harm.
Jeremy Goldkorn is founder of the Chinese media site Danwei.org. Chinese President Hu Jintao just made his first ever appearance in a Chinese chat room to mollify bloggers about an unpopular deal China recently struck with Japan. He said the internet was a great way to tap into the concerns of, quote, the masses. U.S. marketers agree they want to use the net to track our passions. Once, they had to rely on theories, like the one developed by social psychologist Stanley Milgram after experiments conducted in 1967. He determined that there were only 6 degrees of separation between us and that we are all linked by a tiny handful of connectors. This idea of connectors or influencers who start trends affecting the buying patterns of huge numbers of people dominates Malcolm Gladwell's bestseller, The Tipping Point. But as Clive Thompson wrote in Fast Company magazine and explained to Bob in February, Gladwell's idea of influencers is built on the shaky foundation of an outdated study.
He starts off with the Stanley Milgram 6 degrees of separation experiment. You might remember that one. Milgram took a bunch of letters and gave them to people across the country and said, I want you to get them to this stockbroker in Boston. You know, without knowing who this person is, you pass it to a friend who you think is closer. They'll pass it to someone who's closer. And basically, he proved that about 6 degrees of separation is what connected people from this complete stranger. But the really interesting thing was that when it came to the last chain getting to the stockbroker, most of the letters went through just 3 friends. So essentially what Gladwell found interesting is the idea that there were these gatekeepers. He decided that they were connectors, as he called them.
You've spoken to the people who understand this really on a granular level. I'm thinking of Duncan Watts, whom you spent a lot of time with. Tell me about Duncan Watts and what he has to say on this subject.
Well, Duncan Watts is a network scientist at Columbia University. He's actually on leave. He's at Yahoo right now. When Watts actually tried to replicate the Stanley Milgram experiment, he gave thousands of people email and said, well, get it to the stranger. You know, send it to a friend, to a friend, to a friend till it gets to the stranger. And sure enough, 6 degrees was the number of links to get to the stranger. But there were no all-important connector hubs. Only 5% of the messages went through highly connected people. The rest of them just went sort of democratically through people that were weakly connected together. The data seemed to show that those connectors really are not out there in the way that they're supposed to be. What Watts seems to have found, what he argues, is that it's not how influential each person is. It's how influenceable everyone else is. So to put it another way, if society is sort of ready to embrace a trend, almost anyone can start it.
Well, does he offer any insights into how fads or crazes do catch on? Is there any secret that he's been able to ascertain as to why one video goes all over the world in days and another one languishes unviewed on YouTube?
No. And this is actually the particularly distressing answer for people that are in marketing, because they want to know what the secret is. And his answer is that it's actually pretty random. He'll run these simulation models over and over again, and trends will emerge in his virtual societies. But where it will emerge is almost completely random. So his argument is that what you need to do if you want to start a trend is just try and do good old-fashioned mass marketing. Hit as many people as you can, because you don't know who of them is going to be the match that starts the blaze. The other interesting thing about this is that when people talk about influentials, all this theory is all about people in the real world away from their computers just talking to each other. It's very open. If I talk to you about my great new iPod, you know, what do you take away from that? Do you take away my enthusiasm for it? Do you think about the product? Do you just think about music you like? It's very hard to figure out exactly what I'm transmitting to you. Now, online, you've got links. And those are very concrete, specific things. They're not fuzzy at all. And it immediately teleports the viewer to that place. And you can count them via Google and find them. So I think that the way that influence works online with blogs and links may be closer to this old theory of influentials. It may be more real online than it is in the real world.
Now, Watts at the moment is consulting for Yahoo. And I'm curious in what ways he's applying his research to this internet company.
Well, one of the things that Watts has come up with is the idea that, okay, if trends cannot reliably be started by influential people. And if it's true that almost any average slob can start a big trend, well, then what's the best way to start one? He has this thing called big seed marketing, where essentially what you do is you take classic mass marketing, you just blast your message out to the public at large, but you also, in an online forum, allow them some interesting tools to spread and share the message around. He used this piece of software called Forward Track. You'll see the ad he's put online, and it'll say, you know, click here to send it to a friend. Okay, well, most people ignore that. But what ForwardTrack does is that it allows you to send it to your friends, and then you can see who they send it to. And people got sort of addicted to it. And they became very interested in seeing how big they could make their network. He literally turned, you know, ad forwarding and message spreading into sort of a Facebook-like entertainment. And sure enough, he did this with several different campaigns, and essentially for free, they as much as doubled the number of people that saw the ads.
Wow. Well, Clive, as always, thank you so much.
No problem. Take care.
Clive Thompson is a contributing writer for Wired, the New York Times Magazine, and Fast Company. His article, Is the Tipping Point Toast?, is in the February issue of Fast Company magazine.
Up next, an agoraphobe whose ear went round the world. This is On the Media from NPR.
For NPR comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. And the Wallace Foundation, whose Knowledge Center is where education leaders can go to learn about improving teaching and learning. Downloads at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. The music you're hearing is a three-person collaboration. First, Jimmy Giuffre, a pioneering clarinetist and band leader who died in April at the age of 86. The second, Rena Schwartz. It's her high heels you hear echoing in the lobby of a Midtown Manhattan office building 50 years ago. And the third is her husband, Tony Schwartz, who made the recording. This is just one of over 30,000 Schwartz recordings that he recorded so much is all the more remarkable for the constraints under which he did it. Tony Schwartz.
I'm not able to travel far. I have agoraphobia. And in walking, I could just go around my postal zone in the midst of Manhattan. And the postal zone was New York 19 at that time. That was the area I could travel in.
What he lacked in range, he made up in depth, using a new recording device he built himself in 1945.
I made the first portable tape recorder. I brought the VU-meter from inside the case to the top so I could look down at it and see how loud things were. I put a strap on it so I could have it over my shoulder. I could go record children in the park doing jump rope rhymes, and I made 14 records for Folkways Records.
When his recorder was mass-produced, he struck a deal with those who bought it. Send me your sounds, and I'll send you mine. And they did. And when he wasn't dealing strictly in sound, he used his ear to inform his other vocation, TV advertising, much of it political. He's best known for the so-called Daisy ad he made for Lyndon Johnson in the 1964 race against Barry Goldwater, that of a young girl pulling off and counting daisy petals, a sound that dissolved into a man counting down to an atomic blast. And that was all just still a small part of Schwartz's extraordinary legacy as a media theorist, author, record producer, Broadway sound designer, advertising exec, and folklorist. Schwartz died on June 15th. In this piece, the Kitchen Sisters, Davia Nelson and Nikki Silva, reflect back on Schwartz and a life spent listening.
Go to Macy's anymore, more, more. There's a big fat policeman at the door, door, door.
I was interested in the sound around us.
Go to Macy's anymore, more, more.
two things that you're not allowed to carry in taxicab. One is fish, the other is bedding that goes
I had a wrist mic. I had a brush lapel mic, and I would put it on a wristwatch band, and I'd pull it out my sleeve. So I would just walk around and record that way. Like when I went into the pawn shop and I did cab drivers, that way I recorded about 700-800 cab drivers.
Do away with your parking lots in Midtown from 14th Street to 59th Street. No parking allowed in the daytime, only after 6 o'clock. There's your solve your whole
I had recorded the songs on jukeboxes in the restaurants or bars that catered to the various groups around my postal zone. What I would do is get people in the restaurant who spoke English to come over and translate it for me.
The country in which I was born is suffering many, many bad economic things. Even though I'll feel terrible there. In my country there are always flowers. That is my paradise. I won't change Puerto Rico by 60 New Yorks. I won't change Puerto Rican chickens by frozen chickens in the ice boxes here.
This is Max Nichols of Pietermaritzburg, Natal, South Africa, calling Tony Schwartz of New York, USA.
Hello, Tony Schwartz. I'm bringing you greetings from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
This is a Greek folk song from island of Creta.
Hello, Tony. My name is Thomas Knott, and I come from Killarney, Connacherry, Ireland.
When I got my first wire recorder, I asked the company if they would give me the guarantee slips from people from all over the world and all over this country who bought the recorders, who said they were buying them because of their interest in music. And I would exchange wires with people in other countries who were interested in folk music, and they would send me material from their countries.
My name is Tony Schwartz. The music you hear is a Peruvian Indian playing his guitar on a quiet summer evening. This is one of 15,000 recordings I've collected, recordings of folk music and folklore, recordings I've exchanged with people all over the world.
Hello, Tony. I received your letter here the other day. Well, I'm going to send you a wire now, this stuff that I generally do, you know, singing the cowboy stuff. I don't know if you fellas in New York City appreciate this kind of music. We folks around here do this hillbilly stuff.
That's how it started. Recordings came in from all parts of the United States, from all parts of the world. Recordings on wire, recordings on tape. One of my exchanges was with a man who wanted sounds he no longer heard.
Tony, I wonder if you'd do me a favor. I live out in the country, and originally I came from the city, and I kind of miss it. And I was wondering if you would record some sounds of the city and send them out to me. I'd really like to hear it. How about it?
Part of my answer was recorded in Times Square.
What's going on right out? Chinatown, Loney, Oakland, it's Village on the Bar, the Empire State.
A week later, I found this in my mailbox.
Tony, I received your sounds of the city this morning, and I've been playing them ever since. I noticed that you said that you recorded them about 8:30 at night. To sort of reciprocate, here's the sounds of my country, 8:30 at night.
The voices and music of the world came into my apartment in New York City, and I traveled no further than my mailbox.
In people talking, there's an innate musicality in the way certain people speak. And also in the barkers at nightclubs or various places. The sound of selling used to be the people, vendors going by in the street, or people singing in the backyard or shouting in the backyard. Now it's over the radio or television. I did a whole record on the sound of selling. Vegetable men shouting, apples, apples, on the street, with that horse and wagon selling vegetables.
My mule is white, my charcoal is black. I sells my charcoal.
There were men who would go around buying old clothes, and they'd yell, "I cash clothes, I cash clothes."
Charcoal.
I did a radio program on sound once a week on WNYC for over 35 years. I would do it on any subject that came up to me during the week.
Sunday papers all night, Thanksgiving and American news story. Sunday papers all night.
How'd I come to these ideas? Just from being human and working with sound and knowing how sound affected me and affected other people.
Here lies Tony Cherney. Once a pet turtle of Daryl Cherney, died February
24,
1964.
Who died?
My turtle, Tony. He got a sore shell and he tried to save him by giving him hamburger, but he died, and we're going to bury him.
How do you feel about it?
Not too well. Sort of a tragedy for me. I'm going to play taps, and the flag is because I like him. Just like the President of the United States when he died, except, but he's like in my family. Give me the turtle. Why?
Come to me, my melancholy baby. Cuddle up and don't be blue.
Can a baby feel blue?
Anybody can feel blue. All your fears are foolish fancies, maybe.
Well, I was born at the beginning of time. Time magazine started the year I was born. Harry Belafonte was a bop singer when I met him. I got him into the Jamaican songs.
This is another working song. It is the banana loading song. Day oh, day oh, day da light I'm in Wango.
I met a woman who was a cashier at Macy's, and her name was Louise Bennett, and she knew all the Jamaican folklore. And I played those songs to Harry Belafonte. I got from a nightclub in Africa songs like Wim Away, remember that? And Everybody Loves Saturday Night. Wim Away I gave to the Weavers. And Everybody Loves Saturday Night I gave to, what's his name? He owns a casino in Atlantic City. He used to be a singer. He also, I watched Jeopardy on television. You ever watch that? And who was the guy that is the funder of it? Merv Griffin. I gave him Everybody Loves Saturday Night.
Schlaf, mein Kind, schlaf, kisside.
Good morning. Today, I'd like to play two beautiful songs sung by Paul Robeson.
I think he was one of the great singers of our time. And in the McCarthy era, Robeson couldn't travel because they called him a communist, which is ridiculous. He wasn't a communist. He just believed in internationalism. He wanted to send tapes to various places around the world. One I did to send to England for a speech for him. It was about peace, so I had his song behind it. Then I had his narration over that.
Peace and friendship with our great wartime ally, and enduring peace growing out of United Nations, out of friendship with the Soviet people. And the
I did
people
it for many people who couldn't travel, for W.E.B. Du Bois. I would and the record speeches that he wanted to give in South Africa.
Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois of New York, writer and president of the Pan-African Congress, to the peoples of Africa, greeting.
Then when the Hollywood 10 were supposed to go to jail for being un-American, and many of them had made movies that I loved.
The alleged infiltration of communism in the moving picture industry.
I recorded all of them the night before they went to jail. Dalton Trumbo telling what he was accused of.
How did they treat you in front of this committee? I mean,
the committee was anti-Semitic, anti-labor, anti-Negro, pro-war, and had been denounced by everyone from Roosevelt down over
the ridiculousness of this McCarthy era. You know, he started the whole thing of loyalty oaths. Most people think of evil as the sounds of gunfire or thunder or lightning or something.
You, as a witness, if you conduct yourself like
I found and believe that the most evil sounds in the world are the sounds out of mouths of people.
How much more of life burden can I bear?
I've used media to shame people into proper behavior. In primitive cultures, if someone did something shameful and word of mouth got around the village in an hour or so, in our culture, the same thing exists. But if you divide the distance of our country into the speed of sound, you find it would take a 64th of a second to reach across the country by telephone, radio, television, or anything like that. I did a commercial with the Pope against nuclear weapons. I've been against nuclear weapons since 1939. One thing I've done was the Daisy spot for President Johnson. I was working on sound for 6 or 7 commercials in the campaign against Barry Goldwater. One of them was a little girl counting down and picking the petals off a daisy. Then there's the countdown. And then the bomb goes off.
Stakes to make a world in which all of God's children can live or to go into the dark. We must either love each other or we must die.
What would you say to young people who smoke?
I would say that they're very foolish even to consider it. I had to have my voice box removed. I have an hole in my throat. That's what I
teach
through.
A course for NYU. Right. I also teach media and public health at Harvard. Both places come here. I have agoraphobia. I don't travel. I'm not able to travel. I have used the telephone to teach all over the world. In Sweden, in Japan, South America, Australia. My brother built a one-tube radio, which never worked, and I used to go up in the attic and play a spaceship like Jack Armstrong. I was also interested in physics, and the physics teacher was interested in amateur radio, and I first built my own receivers and huge 20-meter antennas, and I built my own little shack where I had 16 by 16, and I had my radio station in the front, my bed in the back, and I ran a telephone line up to the house so my mother could call me in for supper. I made up shortwave listener cards. I speak to them on the radio, and I would tell them how they're coming in. I think the most important thing we can work on in communication is to make the world safer for the people who live in it. People, that's what I was most interested in. People and their their life and what they do.
He'll leave you me as long as you live, and may you live as long as you wish. And don't forget all the money that you spend with me goes to a good cause. Because my wife wants money, the butcher, the baker, everybody wants money. Look at this, you can write Yiddish, you can write English, you can print, you can sketch.
This reflection on Tony Schwartz was produced by Davia Nelson and Nikki Silva, the Kitchen Sisters. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited by me. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson, more engineering help from Zach Marsh, and editorial assistance from Gina Gaspar. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl. Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to our program and find free transcripts at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there or email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. Bob Garfield will be back next week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.